quick. What are you craving right now? Something cheesy, creamy, sweet, maybe spicy or crunchy? Whatever it is, today's guest can make it happen. I'm talking to Sam Turnbull, best-selling author and recipe creator behind the vegan blog, It Doesn't Taste Like Chicken. Sam is a genius when it comes to building flavorful, craveable recipes that will please even the most plant skeptical at the table. And today's episode is jam-packed with practical tips and tricks for making deliciously craveable vegan food and a sneak peek at her latest book, the aptly titled Craving Vegan. Hello, friends. My name is Desiree Nielsen, and you are listening to the All Sorts podcast, where our goal is to make wellness, well, not suck. I started this podcast because I wanted to create a space where you could access evidence-based, positive, and actually useful information about taking care of yourself. A space where you can make choices to help yourself feel better, while also realizing that our health and wellness goes beyond just drinking a green juice to the way our communities are designed, our ability to access culturally and gender-safe healthcare, and even climate change. And yep, we have a podcast on each one of those topics, so be sure to scroll through our archive and give them a listen. Working in nutrition, I've had a lot of conversations about cravings, and most often, it's people asking me what they should do when they have a craving. My advice? Eat what you're craving, because A, trying to eat around a craving never works, and B, eating what you love is actually part of having a healthy relationship with food. Food has always been an important part of my life, and I think so many of us have been conditioned to believe that eating for pleasure isn't aligned with a healthy life, which is a total scam. And that's why these conversations about food, just for the joy of it, will always be a part of what we do here at the All Sorts podcast. Pleasure and enjoyment are an integral part of living well and being well. So let's dive in. Sam, thank you so much for joining us on the All Sorts podcast. I am so excited to chat with you.
I am so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know that I've been like a long time fan of yours. I love like the positive energy that you bring to this space. I also clearly love all of your incredible recipes. And I'm excited to like learn a bit more about you and share sort of like your background and how you came to be this superstar creator and recipe developer with everybody. So I would love to know, because I totally think vegans are superheroes. So like, what is your superhero origin story?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a superhero story, but I mean, everyone starts somewhere, right? I did not grow up vegan, as I think most of us didn't, or plant-based or vegetarian or anything like that at all. I grew up on a farm, and it's a tree farm, but we even had like chickens and ducks for meat and eggs. So like, not vegan. I loved steak. I loved cheese, all the non-vegan things. I thought vegans were crazy, of course, and definitely lacking in protein. Don't we all think that? I was definitely that person who said that at one point in my life. I was like, I think that person's protein deficient. As if I've studied nutrition. But yeah, then one day, it was around Christmas in 2012, I was feeling kind of not great. And so I was like, okay, let me do some research on how to feel healthier. I came across a documentary called Vegucated, and I was like, oh, this is going to be great. It's going to be about vegetables, because everyone knows eat your veggies. But it was actually about going vegan. And that completely changed my mind on everything that I thought I believed. And I actually went vegan overnight. And it was pretty dramatic. I woke up the next day and cleaned out my whole kitchen and got rid of all of the non-vegan products I had, which were a lot, especially because, as we know, like crackers, chips, everything contains milk in it. I don't know why. It's so annoying.
I saw this meme that was like every vegan everywhere. Like, how does this have milk in it? Like, how does this have milk in it?
I know, right? Salt and vinegar chips. Who would think? Yeah. But yeah, after that clean out, I went to the grocery store and stocked up on everything that I could find that was vegan, which turned out to be a lot. It was a hell of a lot of produce, but it was also, you know, tons of other things that I didn't realize were vegan, different types of prepared products, different produce, and all these different things. And I started my vegan journey. And of course, at the time, that was over 10 years ago. So it was pretty difficult. There wasn't a lot of alternatives at the time, and I didn't know what to cook. So I think for like the first 2 weeks, I ate pretty much nothing but spaghetti and tomato sauce, and then the occasional piece of fruit and some crackers I found, things like that. And I thought, this isn't going to be sustainable for me. So I started veganizing my old favorite recipes, and that's how I fell in love with recipe writing.
That's amazing. And it's so funny that you said, you're like, oh, vegans are definitely protein deficient, because like as a dietitian, when I see folks going vegan, now it's very different because there's so much information, there's so much choice out there versus like 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like I see that mistake of people like, okay, amazing, I'm going to go vegan. And then they literally just remove the meat and dairy from everything they ate and then like didn't put anything back. And I was like, that is literally the only way you can be protein deficient as a vegan. Like, if you're just like...
That's what I did at first.
Yeah, totally.
Tomato sauce and spaghetti.
And then you're like, oh, behold the wonders of tofu and lentils, and now everything's okay again.
Exactly, exactly. And protein in all sorts of different places you don't think about it being in as well.
Totally, yeah. Like I think people forget, like even just having two pieces of like whole grain toast with natural peanut butter on it, that's like 15 grams of protein right there. You would look at that and you're like, oh, that's not a protein meal. But that's 15 grams of protein. That's mm-hmm. that's way more than people expect.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think a lot of people, I mean, you would know better than me because it's your expertise, but I think a lot of people overestimate how much protein we actually need to be healthy.
We do. The average North American consumes far more protein than is needed. Absolutely. And there's always, you know, particularly, and this is a bit of a side, but like with protein specifically, you know, a lot of the times in the plant-based community, we talk about like the sort of like national requirement, like your minimum protein needs, which is often a lot lower than I would recommend people consume, because we know that protein makes us feel full and satisfied. But it's true. Like we, like in North America, we overshoot it. Even people on a like predominantly plant-based diet or a fully plant-based diet, we typically get more than we need as long as we're eating enough food. And I think that's a big asterisk for some of us too.
Right. As long as we're not calorie deficient, we're probably getting enough of not starving. Totally. Don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that. Eat, fill your belly. Well, and you know, speaking of filling your belly, I think it's so interesting with your background and you were such a like meat and dairy, you know, sort of driven eater. I think that really informed the recipes you make, because you make so many, like, you make so many creative recipes. I'm like, oh my gosh, like that looks like an egg. And like, so it's these traditional sort of meal styles that would typically have a lot of dairy or eggs or meat. And I think that's so useful and so helpful for folks who are wondering what it would even look like. Because I think sometimes if you've had sort of a traditional, more Eurocentric upbringing where it's like that meat, potato, veg on a plate, like you can't figure out, well, what then, if I remove the meat, like what goes there? And I think that the way that you cook is so helpful for folks like that, because they're like, oh, I get that. Like I get that kind of a meal.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I love a vegetable forward meal as much as the next person. I also really love, like, I didn't go vegan because I hate the taste of animal products. I think a lot of people think, why would you want to replicate something that looks and tastes like meat? And I'm like, because I didn't go vegan because I hate that taste or that texture. I like flavors and textures, actually. I went vegan because I don't want the animal to be harmed, and I know it's probably better for my health and the environment. But if I can create something that has a similar taste and texture and flavor experience, and like you said, it kind of makes it easier to know how to build a meal, then I really love doing that. I find it really fun and really creative, and trying to come up with similar flavors and textures and how you do that, I find it as a recipe writer, it's like super fun to do. And then, yeah, it always gets a little wow factor on the internet, and it always gets some angry trolls, and I love it all. It's really fun.
I feel like that's how you know you're really making an impact. Like if it was only positive comments, you're like, I might not be reaching enough people then. Like you need to like extend yeah. your reach into that like sphere where maybe the trolls come, which is terrible. I don't know. Sometimes I don't know how people do it, but I do think that's like a really valid point that people say, oh, well, if you're vegan and like meat, like why don't you just eat me? And you're like, well, the reason why it's not because you didn't like the taste. It's not because like those textures weren't satisfying. And I think that's really an important message for people to hear. Like we get it. We get the cheese is mm-hmm. delicious. Like, we get that meat is yeah. delicious. But also, we can make all these things from plants.
Yeah, and nobody has to die, which is great. And it's also just really fun, and it makes it easier for people to kind of imagine a plant-based diet. And that's not for everyone, as we know. Some people, I even get messages from vegans all the time who are saying, well, I'm vegan and I would never want something that looks or tastes like meat. And I'm like, well, that's fine. That's what you do. That's great. There's other people that do want that. And so I like to try to provide those recipes.
Totally. Well, and like, you know, vegans are not a monolith, right? Like, I think the thing that unites yeah. us is we're like, okay, we're down with animals. Like, we got you, buddies. But like, we all have different styles, different tastes, different like culinary and cultural backgrounds, and all that's going to inform how we eat, which is totally how it should be, right?
Exactly. And that's another nice thing about making these types of things is a lot of people associate different traditions and routines with food as well. So someone might have a steak dinner every Sunday night with their family, or pepperoni pizza on Fridays. And so if you can still do those things but make them plant-based, then it can be really nice. You don't have to give up some of your favorite foods and traditions. You just have to alter them ever so slightly.
Yeah, totally. And I think it's just so much easier now too than like 10 years ago. I mean, like, the cheeses and all those kind of things that are available, you know, particularly like, I'm the only vegan in my entire family. And so like, when I go to my in-laws, who still create rather traditional meals, like, something that is so helpful is that my mother-in-law totally gets, she's like, oh, I can just pick up Beyond sausages for breakfast in the morning. Mm. Like, she's figured out how to like veganize the waffles with some like oat milk. And, but then she's like, oh yeah, like, I understand this because I put a sausage with a waffle. And so for you, I just buy you a different sausage with the waffle. And like, it makes it so simple.
Exactly. Yeah. It makes it really easy for people, which is great, because it's one thing to tell people to go vegan, but it's another thing to tell people to go vegan and then give up everything that they know about food and love about food and how to make it. And now all you have to eat is lentils.
Yeah.
Like, sure, lentils are great. I love lentils, but there's other things
yes.
too.
A woman cannot survive on lentils alone.
No.
So when you were started, because you were also sort of raised in this environment, and when you started going, so you talked about watching Veggiecated, like, what were some of the mm-hmm. the supports, like, whether it was like more movies or books, or even like, I don't know, did you like seek out like vegan Facebook groups, or like, what were some of the things that really helped support you as you were like getting your footing in all of this?
Yeah. So at first, I watched that documentary, which changed my mind, which was great. But I'm pretty stubborn. So I was like, okay, I'll give it a shot. But this isn't going to really work. This isn't like really the best diet. This isn't really a good thing. So I was kind of almost like doing it, but looking for holes in it. So I started watching a lot more documentaries. So I watched Forks Over Knives, and different documentaries came out later on, What the Health, Cowspiracy, Game Changers. Those are all great as well. I read a lot of books on animal cruelty, on nutrition, on the planet as well. And basically, the more I researched and the more I looked into it, the more I realized that there are no holes in this. You can't argue with it, really, in my opinion. I think it's the right thing to do. So once I had that, then I was like, okay, now I can be stubbornly vegan. And then it was a lot easier. I didn't have any vegan friends or family at the time. So I didn't really get support there. I did go originally to like vegan meetups in Toronto, which was kind of cool, just to meet some like-minded people. But yeah, mainly it was just me having attitude. And then starting my blog too, because I was able to post my recipes online, and through the online world, as we all know, one of the most amazing things about it is that you can find your people.
Yeah, it is. There's a lot of downsides to the internet in 2023, but one of the really strong upsides is like, oh, even if I feel like the only person in my friend group or my family or my community, like, you can go online and be like, oh, there's a whole bunch of other people who are eating like me or thinking this way. It's kind of amazing.
Exactly. It's amazing. Yeah. Well, it's great.
And you mentioned your blog because it's incredible. And so I feel like a lot of people start that as like, oh, here, I'm on this journey. I'm on this exploration. Let me like share it with the world. So was that like how and why it started for you?
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to basically show my friends and family that vegan food didn't have to be weird, because I did grow up in a very like food centric house. I know a lot of chefs, and you know, the conversations around breakfast were what we're going to make for dinner. Like, every day the meal was a big production. So when I first went vegan, I think my family thought like, oh, you're never going to enjoy food again. And I'm like, no, I will. I promise. So I started posting my recipes online, and then I started getting comments from people all over the world who were enjoying my recipes, and that's what really made me fall in love with it. And that's when I started taking it seriously and dedicating all my free time to it, and then probably too much time. I even did a little blogging while I was at my other job at the time. It's okay, I've been working years. But yeah, it was just really fun.
Well, and I would love to talk to you a little bit more about that, because I think if you are inside this world, you know what it's all about. But if you are someone who enjoys a recipe blog or enjoys following their favorite creators on Instagram or TikTok, they don't really get how much work goes into it. Do you do all this work yourself? Mm-hmm. Do you have a team? How long did you do this all yourself? What does it actually take to make these videos, to make these recipes?
Yeah, it takes a lot. I mean, I think one of the common questions I get or see people do when they're new vegans, then they make a bit of a mistake, especially when it comes to baking, is that they see those little graphics where it says, oh, to replace an egg, all you have to do is use flaxen water or applesauce or something like that, which is great, but also kind of not helpful, because I find that those don't necessarily translate one-to-one for every recipe. So I really find it helpful for people to follow a vegan recipe specifically instead of trying to convert their old favorite recipes, because it does take a lot of recipe testing. It took me, especially when I started out, I would test recipes 5, 6, 7 times before I posted them, really doing all these crazy experiments in my kitchen. So it took a lot. But yeah, over the last 10 years I've been doing it, it was all me for a very long time. And then I got some help with my amazing assistant, Jess, and she's been working with me. She kind of does some of the back end stuff and helps with all the management. And then during the pandemic, my husband joined the team as well. And so now he does all the filming, all the video editing, and he does all the business side of things. So yeah, it's grown over the years. It's not just me anymore, but it allows me to do what I like the most, which is create the recipes and take the photos.
That's amazing. And so I think people would be really surprised, it takes 3 people to make all of this happen. I think people would be so surprised that it takes 3 whole people, because I think people see a photo and they're oh, you just threw that up and it took 15 minutes. I mean, you started out by having to test your recipe 7 times before you even posted anything. It's so much dedication, so much time, so much effort that goes in. And it's so funny what you said about the swapping, because the other thing that I find with blogs, you'll work so hard, you'll perfect this recipe and you put it in, and then people were I didn't use wheat flour, I used oat flour, and then I didn't use this, I used this, and they changed 4 things, and and the recipe didn't work.
Yeah, -7 stars.
Yeah. -7 stars, you suck. Yeah.
I get those comments all the time as well. But if you actually follow the recipe, I'm pretty sure it'll work out great.
Yeah, so for anyone, anyone following blog recipes, definitely, unless you're a very skilled cook, follow the recipe to a T the first time and then maybe start making swaps. Maybe.
Exactly. I definitely always recommend that, especially when it comes to baking or making seitan or anything that takes a little bit more chemistry. Because, yeah, if you change an ingredient, it can affect how the outcome is completely, texture, if it rises, if it's a dense, awful thing, or if it's delicious and fluffy, it can change it a lot.
Oh my gosh, baking particularly. It's so funny because as a dietitian, I'm very science-based, but it is the science of baking that just messes with me every single time. And, particularly because a lot of the stuff that I started doing, because I have so many digestive clients in my practice. So I was doing a lot of gluten-free and vegan and also low sugar bake. When you take the starch and the gluten out and then you lower the sugar, I had so many fails when I was starting to develop muffins that
probably more than 7
sometimes. So there was one recipe in Eat More Plants. It was the chocolate breakfast cupcake. And it took me 12 times to get that right. Wow. 'Cause I was just figuring out how to do vegan gluten-free baking. And then people would be like, can I change this flour? I was like, no. I was like, if you change this flour, this will be a hot fudge, not a muffin. Don't do it.
Hey, hot fudge is good too, right?
Delicious, if that's what you're going for. Not if you want to eat it in your hand like a muffin.
That's funny. Yeah. Good for you. Gluten-free baking is not my expertise.
now that I've introduced like sort of more like standard recipes, like, oh my gosh, gluten is a magical ingredient. It's incredible. You just throw it in there and the like stuff rises. It blows me away every single time.
Yeah, it's all fluffy and great. No, I love gluten. I mean, I do have a lot of gluten-free recipes as well, but not so much specifically in the baking category, because that's a whole other thing. And I get comments like that on my blog too. It's like, every recipe you post should be gluten-free, and because that's how most vegans eat. And I'm like, no, man, there's all kinds of vegans.
No, and vegans eat gluten-free because oftentimes when you go to a restaurant, they're like, you're the weirdo with all the dietary restrictions. We're going to pile all of them in the same recipe.
They do that a lot.
You're like, no, but I like gluten. Gluten is delicious. Please give it to me.
They give you the gluten-free bun and it like falls apart. I'm like, oh, I do feel bad for the gluten-free people because there isn't a lot of great options, but I think they're getting better as well.
They're definitely getting a lot better, but for some reason restaurants are just like not there yet. Okay, we should switch to talk to your new cookbook since we were talking about cookbooks already, because you have multiple incredible cookbooks, but you have a brand new cookbook called Craving Vegan, and there it is. Yay. Oh my God, the cover is so pretty. It's like,
oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's so fun. What was your inspiration for this book?
Well, it actually started on talking on a podcast, and there was a few people on the podcast, and we were asked, when we think of comfort food, what do we think of? And a few people answered kind of similarly. They said, you know, home-cooked meals, that kind of thing. But what I actually thought, I'm like, no, that for me, that's not comfort food. Comfort food is different textures and flavors. So when I think of comfort food, I think of something crunchy or spicy or meaty or chocolatey, all depending on my mood. And so I based a book strictly around cravings instead of around meal types. So the chapters aren't soups and salads and sandwiches, things like that. Instead, the chapters are eggy, carby, creamy, cheesy, crunchy, spicy, meaty, chocolatey, and sugary. Oh my God, so good.
Which honestly, when I opened it, I was like, oh, jackpot. Like, because I think it's so true, right? Like, I love ice cream, but if I'm craving something salty and crunchy, like, I don't want the ice. Like, it is so specific. And you're like, what do I want to eat? Like, what's like that taste that's like almost on the tip of my tongue right now? Like, what do I want to eat right now? And then you can just like open it and be like, oh yeah, I definitely want cheesy right now. Like, and just go straight to those. Those are so genius.
Thank you. Thank you. And that's how I think about food a lot of the time when I go to make dinner or lunch. I don't generally think I want a soup for lunch. I think I want something really creamy and luscious, or I want something like super spicy. It's going to blow my head off, you know, depending on that. That's kind of how I think of food. And so it was really fun to build a book strictly around these kinds of cravings and tastes and textures.
Well, and one of the things that I like as a dietitian that I love about that is that it really hammers home this idea that food is also joy and pleasure. Because I think there is like outside of the vegan world, this idea that somehow like vegans don't like food. It's like, no, we love food. You just haven't figured out how to make the food that we love, which is why we do it ourselves. But like, yeah, you know,
exactly.
But that it is like, yes, food nourishes our body. Yes, it provides us with nutrition, but it is a joy. Like, what a gift to be able to eat three meals a day. And the fact that you can like have joy and pleasure from that experience just makes your day like so much better.
Yeah, exactly. It's so comforting. I think it's really good for us, like mentally, physically, just being able to share a meal or even by yourself, watch a movie, cozy up with one of your favorite dishes. I think it's really good. And a lot of us have the privilege of going to these grocery stores that have ingredients that are like all across the board, you know, all over the world, all sorts of kinds of produce and interesting things. So it's really fun to be able to use all of that and make something really special.
Yeah, I totally agree. And something else that's really so genius about your book is that you talk a lot about, you know, like what ingredients, particularly around the whole eggy chapter. I feel like this season I've talked to multiple people about the obsession that is like egg replacement, because it's not like, you know, like milk is so easy. It's like, well, there you go. Take your pick, like soy milk, oat milk, like, you know, like
that's an easy one. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very easy. Whereas eggs are a little bit different. And so you've provided like a lot of education on like what do you use to swap? And the other thing that I saw that you did, which I really appreciated, because grocery bills are skyrocketing right now is that, you know, you've also talked about like taking ingredients that might be like pricier or harder to find and making them more accessible. So I thought it would be really fun to do like a fun swaps Q&A if you're up for it.
Sure, ask.
Okay, cool. So cashews can be a little bit of an issue because cashews are really pricey. And I love cashews so much because like a cashew Alfredo is like 100% the whole reason I could easily go vegan. So what can you swap for cashews?
Yeah, so I get this question a lot too because people also tend to have allergies to cashews. Not everyone, of course, but some of us. So my favorite alternative for that is both affordable and friendly if you have a nut allergy is sunflower seeds, raw sunflower seeds. So when you use them, generally you're using cashews to make a cheese or a creamy sauce. So you want to soften the sunflower seeds. So you can do that by soaking them, or I like to just do a little quick hack and boil them for about 15 minutes. And that also releases some of the kind of more bitterness when you boil them, which is really good. And then you can blend them up. They don't have exactly the same flavor, but they tend to be a little bit more bitter, a little more tart. So when I use those instead of cashews, I'll often add just like a little pinch of agave or something like that just to kind of cut that flavor a bit.
Oh my God, that's incredible. I have never heard anyone say boil the sunflower seeds. Like I've absolutely done a hot soak, but that boiling is like an incredible tip.
Oh, yeah. I'm not very good at planning ahead of time for the most part. Right. So even if I think I'm going to, I'm like, okay, here's my meal plan for the whole week. And then I completely forget to, you know, soak the nuts or whatever. So yeah, I always just boil them. It's so much faster.
Oh my God. That's genius. Okay. You also had a really great swap for panko because panko crisp, they're so nice and crispy and crunchy, but not everybody can find them in their like corner supermarket. So what would you swap for panko crumbs when you're doing a breading?
Yeah, cornflakes. So easy. Works great. And you can just crunch them up a little bit with your hands or throw them in a food processor and just blitz them a few times. And it'll get a really nice crunchy coating, which is great. I use it on my cauliflower wings. So it gets a really nice crunchy coating and it feels like it's fried, but it's not. So that's also nice too.
Okay, cool. I love that. All right. So let's talk about omelets, because of course we have just egg, which works really, really well. Mm. It's also a tiny, tiny little bottle for a lot of dollars. What would you swap if you wanted to make an omelet?
Yeah, so the main ingredient in just egg actually is mung bean. So why not just go straight to the bean? So mung beans are great. They're kind of similar to lentils. And if you just soak them and blend them up with some seasoning, you have your own homemade just egg. It's very easy.
Amazing. Okay, last one. Jackfruit is a really cool ingredient because, you know, you just open it up in a can and it sort of looks like a shredded meat. Like you can do like a pulled pork style thing. But I also know that not everybody can find jackfruit, or sometimes you can find like the sweet jackfruit and not the like in brine. Don't make that mistake. Your dinner's going to taste weird. What would you swap for it?
So artichoke hearts are also a really good swap. They have that kind of flakiness. I really like them, especially for fish substitutes, because they're quite briny usually as well. And so they can be a really nice option. Or if you want to do something else for jackfruit, not as flaky, but chickpeas are always good. Or you could also do heart of palms, which I find are usually a little bit easier to find. They're a bit more tender, but they do have that flakiness. So they do make a nice alternative as well.
I love that. That's awesome. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about like flavor, because I really want to hammer this. Like, this is my agenda, like my sneaky vegan agenda for this conversation is like, hey, we like flavor and highly flavorful vegan food is available for everyone. So
like, we like the flavor.
Yeah. So when you're building a pantry with like flavor in mind, like what are some of the ingredients you're like, you need to have this because it makes food so delicious?
Yeah, well, again, it depends on what flavor you're going for. But in eggy, if you haven't heard of black salt, it's also called kalanamak. So in the eggy chapter, we use that a lot because it tastes a lot like egg. It's the weirdest thing. It's a salt, but it has a very sulfuric taste, which sounds gross, but that's kind of what eggs taste like. So that's a really good one. If you just add a little bit of that to any dish, it'll instantly have a bit of an eggy flavor. For cheesy, I'm sure we're all fans of nutritional yeast by now, but I also like to use things like miso paste, which add a lot of umami and kind of make it taste like it's been aged for a while, kind of has an aged flavor without needing to let something actually age on your counter for a long time. So that's a really good hack. For meaty, one of my favorite ingredients is liquid smoke. which you can actually find usually in almost every grocery store. People think you can't find it, but I swear it's usually there.
I was like, do I have it in mine? I don't know.
I think you do. Any major grocery store. It's always like with the barbecue sauces, but it's usually a very small bottle and it's usually like right on the top shelf or right on the bottom shelf. So it's like hidden almost. And that's great because just a few drops will make something have a very nice smoky flavor without needing to smoke it. And that's a really nice trick for making something meaty.
That's awesome. I have to say, I don't use liquid smoke like I could. And now I'm going to go to my grocery store. I'm going to be like, okay, where is it?
Oh, it's a game changer. You're going
to
love it.
Okay. I have to do it because I'm very...
Smoked paprika is also great, but liquid smoke, it will just take it to the next level.
Yeah. Smoked paprika is my current hack, but yeah, I really have to try that out.
Yeah. And a lot of people think liquid smoke is a weird ingredient or very fake. It's actually not. It's the condensation collected from a fire. So you could even make it yourself if you want to do that. But it's very safe to consume. It doesn't have the same kind of carcinogens as cooking on a barbecue or anything like that. So it's also a nice alternative if you're trying to reduce carcinogens.
Yeah, that's also a really good point because I do feel like people look at it and be like, how do you make smoke liquid? That doesn't seem very natural.
It's just water.
It's just water, I promise.
Smoky water.
Well, and in your book too, you even go so far as to have this like flavor cheat sheet, which I really appreciate. Cause like one of the things, like as a self-taught cook, it is so cool. Honestly, everybody get this book because it's going to help you enormously. But as a self-taught cook, one of the things that really changed the game for me is when I started tasting my food and having the confidence to adjust it. Like you follow a recipe and then you sit down to like eat dinner and you haven't tasted it and you're like, oh, I don't like this. Whereas there's so many opportunities through the cooking processes like to taste and be like, oh, it tastes flat. How do I fix that? Or it's too bitter or it's too sour. How do I fix that? And so like, can we talk a little bit about that? Like, how do you sort of like alter things? Like you talked about with the sunflower seeds. They tend to be a little bit more tart, a little bit more bitter than cashews. Mm-hmm. And so you add the agave. Like, how do we sort of go about all these things?
Yeah. So, of course, everyone has different flavor and taste preferences. And every recipe writer writes the recipe according to what they think tastes best. So that's what I do. But of course, not everyone is going to agree with that it tastes exactly the way they want. So if something is too bland, you can easily just enhance that by using the same spices that are in the recipe, just more. Also, a lot of times when you're doing a recipe and if it tastes too bland, it could just be that you're using less potent spices. If they're old, they can get a little bit less potent. Or if you get them from different areas, different stores, they can vary a lot in flavor. So things like that can really help. But also if something comes out too salty, I know that happens to people a lot, you can tweak that. A good thing to do is add something acidic, such as vinegar or lemon juice. It can help cut that salty flavor. Or if something is too sour, you can, of course, add something sweet. Or if something is too bitter, you can think of coffee. You can add something a little bit creamy or something a little bit sugary. And that'll help cut those flavors. So whenever you're making a recipe, it's always good to follow the recipe the way it's written. That's what I always recommend, whether it's my recipe or not. And then if you find it has one of these things where it's like, oh, it's a bit too spicy for me. It's a little bit too intense. It's a little bit too bland. You can always just write a little note to yourself. Next time, add more of this. And so I have a little cheat sheet in my book talking about exactly what to do in each instance.
It's so helpful because I, you know, and it's funny as a recipe developer, because one of my fears is like, well, what if people don't like the way it tastes? Like, I like the way it tastes, but I love everything. Like, more is more in my book. I'm like, I want more spice. I want more acid. I want more salt. And so I'm always like trying to like temper that, you know, with, well, maybe people are going to think it's too salty or there's like too much cumin. But it's so great to, once you've had the recipe and made it yourself and you're like, now you make it your own.
Exactly, exactly. And everyone is different, right? I love salt. So I actually try to always like reduce it a little bit when I publish my recipes because I probably like it more than most people do. But even still, I know that my mother-in-law, for example, she doesn't cook with salt at all. So I'm sure when she tastes my food as written, it would be too salty for her. So for her, she could just cut the salt or reduce the soy sauce, those kinds of things. Everyone has different tastes and that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that is the big thing is be like, no, 100%. Like, you can make this your own. And there are all those like little things that you can do once you've tasted a dish and you're like, oh no, I need to adjust this. Like you don't have to just say, oh, this dish didn't work. Like throw it in the compost. You're like, you can always fix it up.
Yeah. Don't waste food.
Yeah, please don't.
Ideally. Unless it's like rubber or something.
Yeah. Unless you've burnt it to an actual crisp and mm-hmm. cannot like chew through it, then don't.
Yeah.
Okay. Totally. I want to ask because I mean, partially self-serving as a West Coaster, but also I love knowing for people who are in the food world, like where they like to eat. So I also wanted to ask you some of your fave vegan places in the Toronto area.
So I'm in Toronto, so those are the places I know. One of my absolute favorites is a place called Fat Choi. It's actually a pop-up within the restaurant called Seuss. Seuss is not a vegan restaurant, but if you ask for the Fat Choi menu, it is an all-vegan menu. And one of the best things you can do there is get what's called Feed Me, and they just bring you all these different dishes, and it's you eat so much food, and it's so good and so flavorful. So I really love that. I especially always like to take people there because it's a really fun experience because you get so much different kinds of food. And then some of my other restaurants is I love the Plantas. There's Planta Queen and Planta Yorkville, and they're both really lovely and fun too. And they're always really creative with the way that they make different dishes, and it's so good.
I have to try. Okay, Fat Choi, this is new for me. And I have a couple of trips coming up. So now I'm like, okay, I have to go.
Oh, you got to go. Yeah, we should go together. It'd be fun.
That would be so much fun. Yeah, I love, you know, I feel like Vancouver is a very, very good vegan city, but Toronto is just like bigger. There's like, bigger, there's more. And so it's so exciting to explore.
We're like, very lucky. 10 years ago, there was like one vegan restaurant, but now you can drive around and I spot them all the time, which is crazy. I'm like, oh, I didn't know there was a vegan restaurant there. I got to check that out.
I know, totally. Especially since 2020, like we don't go out as much as we used to. And then like instantly you're like, oh, what happened there? Like, how did that pop up? And I had like no idea that it existed until now.
Exactly. It's pretty great.
So you have an incredible new cookbook coming out. What else is on the horizon for you? What does Sam want out of her beautiful, it doesn't taste like chicken empire?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so I'm really excited about the launch of Craving Vegan, of course. It's my third cookbook, so it's like, I don't know, feels even more exciting than the first one somehow. and then in the winter, I'm planning on doing another cooking course. So I do online cooking courses on the website, The Ultimate Vegan Kitchen. That's what it's called. And so I'm going to be doing a whole course on how to make seitan, which if your audience doesn't know, seitan is not gluten-free, unfortunately, but it is actually a meat alternative that is made from wheat protein, which is called gluten.
You know, I feel like, say, I've been having this conversation with a couple of people this year about how seitan needs and is probably primed for, like, its time in the, like, North American vegan spotlight because there is this whole weird thing about gluten, which if you don't have celiac disease, gluten is wonderful. But it's so, like, let's actually talk about this. Like, it's so versatile, right? And the texture of it is so different. Like, what are some of the things you like to make with seitan?
Oh, everything. So everything from in the cookbook, actually, in Craving Vegan, you will find ribs, which is really cool, a rack of ribs, which tastes and looks like ribs, which is really great, except for the bone. I didn't bother putting a bone in because I didn't need to gnaw on something. But in the course, we're going to be doing everything from sausages and hot dogs to deli meats to a stuffed Thanksgiving turkey to steaks to chicken. Like basically every kind of meat you could think of is what we're making. And it's really fun. It's a really fun process, but it's very much like chemistry. So it is a very specific thing. So that's why it's really good to have a course where I'm going to be showing you exactly how to do it step by step. It's all recorded live. So you get to see it in real time. There's no like quick edit. So it's like, ta-da, it's now done and out of the oven and it looks perfect. And you're like, wait, how did you do that?
I missed the in-between bit.
Exactly. So it'll be really fun. And I think you're right. Seitan is a really old food. It comes from the 6th dynasty of China. what Buddhist monks made, because of course they were vegan or plant-based as well. So it's not anything new, but of course we've taken the original idea and kept playing with it. And by adding different things like liquid smoke and smoked paprika and different salts and seasonings and soy sauce and tomato paste and all sorts of different fun things. And of course we also add in beans and lentils and tofu and things like that to get various different textures. And it's very cool. When you're done, you have something that is very meaty, looks and tastes like meat, which, as we know, I like. Yeah. But isn't meat. No animals got harmed. So it's really fun and really exciting. And I've fed all of these recipes both to vegans and to meat eaters, and everyone is blown away and loves them. So there's no discrimination there. Everyone's just like, wow, this is amazing.
Well, and that's such a win too, because I think, you know, if you don't have a lot of vegans in your friends or family group and you want to like invite folks for dinner and have them enjoy what you're eating. I think there's that little bit like, so what do I make that's going to be like satisfying to meat eaters? And so seitan is such a win so that you can create those textures and like everyone's going to be like, wow, I can't believe this is vegan food.
Exactly. I also always think whenever I'm hosting someone for dinner and they're not vegan, I always ask myself, I'm like, okay, is this like an adventurous person or is this like a person who's scared of this kind of thing? Because if it's someone who's scared, I might make like a lentil ragu or something like that, or maybe even something a little bit more creative, like a vegan quiche, but I probably wouldn't make them a vegan steak. But if I have a friend who is much more adventurous in cooking and is going to be excited about that, I have one friend who loves my seitan chicken wings and request them every time she comes over now. So it's really fun.
Oh, that's so amazing. Okay. I feel like this is the perfect time to switch into the rapid fire questions. I close every episode with rapid fire, nice little softballs, which sometimes end up being like, oh, that's a much harder question than I thought. But anyways, we want to get to know you better. So what is your fave way to unwind at the end of the day?
I have two different ways depending on my mood. I love a nice glass of white wine and to watch a movie with my husband and just put my feet up, or some really trashy reality TV, also great. Or if I'm just needing some alone time, I like to play video games. So I do that.
Amazing. Okay, what video games?
Right now I'm playing Hogwarts Legacy, which is really fun.
I love that. That's amazing. Okay, sweet or savory? You can only choose one.
Savory.
Me too.
I do love sweet, but savory all the way.
Your favorite part about being a creator and recipe developer?
Oh, that I get to be fun and creative all the time. And I just get to come up with ideas and people like it and I'm able to make a living at it. It seems like a dream.
It is a dream. Taco or burrito?
Ooh, both are so good. I think taco though.
Okay. The cuisine you would want to travel for?
Oh my goodness, all of them?
I know. It's an unfair question.
I've been to Italy. I think I haven't been to any of Asia yet. So maybe like Japan or something like that. I'd really love to do that and try the food there.
Amazing. Oh, Sam, thank you so much. Congratulations on your beautiful new book, Craving Vegan, and for sharing all of these like awesome tips and tricks with us. I think it's going to be really helpful for people who are just like finding their footing or people who are just in like a food rut, because it happens to us all.
It does happen, yeah. So now you don't have to worry about different categories. You can just think, oh, what do I feel like eating? Do I want something creamy or cheesy or maybe medium spicy?
I'm like, I would have a hard time between those four. I'm like, those are the four that I feel like creamy, cheesy, spicy. And those are the things I crave the most often. So I'm very excited about it.
I also have some fun twists where in my chocolatey chapter, it's not all sweet. I have two savory recipes there as well. So those are really rich and full of umami, of course, because chocolate is very bitter naturally. So it's a really fun thing.
Totally. I always put chocolate in my chili. That's like my hack.
Yes. Nice. Yes. Yeah. Nice. I love it. Thank you so much. I'm really excited about the book. Thank you for having me on your podcast. This has been very fun. My cheeks hurt from smiling so much.
I know you do.
Such a good time.
I love Sam so much. She brings so much positivity and fun to the vegan food space, and her recipes will convince anyone, and I mean anyone, that they can enjoy a vegan meal. Her new book, Craving Vegan, is out now, and I highly recommend you pick it up at your local bookshop or library and consider maybe buying it as a gift for all of your food-loving friends. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the All Sorts podcast, which is produced by myself and edited by Brian McCallman. We are grateful to live and work on the unceded and ancestral territory of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. Until next week, friends, be well.